Hello and welcome to the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week we are going back to the great Georges Franju and his classic, Eyes Without a Face. Joining me today is Alex Baker, the usual interviewer for Armchair Directors. Welcome, Alex.
Nice to be here. Tables have turned, haven't they?
They have. I'm on the power side of the desk this time. So what was your overall opinion of the film?
I really liked it. To tell a little bit, I guess, why I chose this film and why I wanted to turn the tables a little bit. This play, I saw this just a month ago, maybe a little over a month ago, the first time. And since then, I've already seen it four times. And it first played on Turner Classic. They were doing something for Halloween. And I watched it. I just really got into it. And I think what I really like about it is, A, it's really gutsy for a, I mean, no pun intended, but really gutsy for a 1960 movie with its violence. I mean, nowadays, put it up against something like a Saw movie or one of those gory horror movies, that's not that bad. But for 1960, it's pretty graphic. That's what I really liked. And I think even though it's bloody, it's pretty violent, it's also very poetic. There's a lot of really good, really beautiful imagery in the movie. And I think I love that mixture between violence and poetic beauty, as you would say.
It reminded me very much of classic fairy tales, which are always really dark and kind of gory.
Yeah,
you forget that part.
Yeah,
and older.
She's definitely like the classic literature, like a Frankenstein's monster in a way.
In a way, yeah, that's a good, an interesting way of looking at it. Do you know anything about the book that this is based on?
I actually looked forever trying to find it on Amazon and stuff because I really wanted to buy it, but it's hard to find. I do know that it's even more violent and graphic than the movie. Like in the movie, like remember when it's the end and he's doing some testing on the dogs? They lightly reference it. They go into more detail about what the type of medical testing he does on the dogs in the movie. And from what I've read, it's more violent. So
that's actually kind of hard to believe because I think the violence is understated, but the suspense is just unbearable when you're waiting to see what's underneath that mask. And you know at some point they're going to show you. Mm-hmm. And there's all these little teases where you think she's going to turn her head and she doesn't.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like the Twilight Zone when the all the people are revealed to be pigs.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like that.
Yes, or the one where the woman thinks that she's horribly disfigured, and it turns out that she's beautiful, and the people...
Yeah, that's the one standard, where they're
okay,
pigs.
Yeah. Really very, very similar to lots of things that have come out since. But speaking of 1960, that was the year that Psycho came out as well, which was groundbreaking in its depiction of horror. How would you compare the two?
There's definitely a lot of similarities, but when I was reading it, I think what it's more similar as far as violence, I know this was like France's answer to what England was doing with their Hammer horror films. This is like what they had with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. And those movies were always noted for being very bloody. Like, and they always had that, like, because of their color films, that they were always, like, very bright red blood. It wasn't just regular looking blood. It was very bright. It really stuck out in the camera. I think that's what they were, when I read that Georges Franju, the director, that's what he was trying to do with this film. He wanted to make France's answer, so you think that's bloody, I'm going to show you somebody getting their face taken off surgically.
Literally.
Yes.
Well, the movie has lots of classic characters. So let's start with the mad doctor character, played by Pierre Brasseur, who... had done a lot of stuff with Michel Carnet, like Children of Paradise and Port of Shadows. But this is such a dark role, but it is such a, you can see the, what people did with that kind of thing in later films.
Yeah, he is, in one way, your typical mad scientist. He doesn't care. He shows, he'll do whatever it takes to achieve his result. Even if that means kidnapping innocent women and surgically removing their faces, he will do that. If it's doing medical testing on dogs, he will do that. He's doing everything. But even when he does these horrible things, I guess in a way, I'll have to ask you this too. You feel not a heck of a lot, but you do feel some sympathy for him, because even one line he does realize that, you know, when he's done the surgery and he's saying like, I've done so much bad to do perform a miracle. So I think even he realizes that what he's doing is wrong, but he just wants to help save his daughter, because in a way, it was his fault that what happened.
See, it's hard to justify. Obviously.
Oh, I'm not justifying it at all.
But justify.
I guess say I
what he's doing, though, is he's removing the faces of women to make up for the fact that his daughter has no face. I mean, he really should take off his own face.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who did this.
That'd be tough to take off your own face.
It would be tough, but it can't be any harder than what they show in the movie. All right, how about the creepy sidekick character, in this case, Alita Valli, who seems to be reprising her role from the third man.
Yeah, she has really bad choice in lovers.
She does. She cannot pick them.
But yeah, and she's she's creepy, too. I think what's terrifying is, you know, she wears that tight necklace around her neck.
Yes, the choker.
The choker. And she kind of has that cigarette curling, and she drives that little, really tiny, like, Volkswagen. And she's when the creepy carnival music's playing, whenever she's on the hunt for a new victim, and she's just creepily watching. And she was really good in this movie. A little bit different from her role in The Third Man, but yeah, you can definitely see some similarities.
A little bit of a Mrs. Danvers, too, from Rebecca. She just has that sort of ghoul guarding the mansion and the sort of an Igor role. Because she's helping provide the victims and luring them to their death. And she's been a beneficiary of this doctor's genius. In the end, I thought he was going to take her face off again and put it on the girl. You know, that's how my mind works. Like, what are they going to do with this character to get even with her?
It is definitely a different take on the, you know, the evil sidekick. You know, typically this was even parodied in Young Frankenstein, but you have the hunchback sidekick who's got, like, some sort of gross deformity and everything. In this one, it's Alita Valli, and, you know, she's very beautiful. So I like the different take on the sidekick, the henchman.
Yeah, almost a film noir take on the femme fatale.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely, you bring up a good point about film noir. I would say this film is very film noir-ish as far as its use of light and shadows, even, you know, like especially in the scientist's lair and even in the dog pit.
And the evil in us all, you know, brought to light with these things. The choker, by the way, I thought that was a really interesting detail because I noticed the pearls right away. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, they're really focusing on the pearls. But it reminded me of those campfire stories where, you know, someone is wearing a black velvet choker and they never take it off. And then one day somebody makes them take it off and they're actually, you know, that's the only thing holding their head on. It rolls away. as soon as they show you that she has a scar underneath that, I could not help but think about those campfire stories. That and the black hand that comes and chokes you to death and it's a disembodied hand.
And like, then she removed the necklace and there was a scar.
Yes.
So you did talk, I'd like to talk a little bit about the music in the film.
Yes.
One thing I noticed when I was looking at the credits when I first watched this, it was done by Maurice Jarre. And just 2 years later, we would see him become an all-time great with the score for Lawrence of Arabia. And, you know, this was I really like the music in this film as well. It's because it's whenever you have that theme of Alita Valli's character, it's like, it's very creepy, carnivalesque. But then you have the more softer, like sad, romantic score with Christiane whenever she's sort of just walking through and sort of like melancholy despair with the mask on.
Yeah, and that character too is another stock character, is, you know, the beautiful victim. Mm-hmm. And at first when you see her, you think, wow, she really has very wide set eyes. And then they show you her with the mask on and it's very doll-like. Then they have her dressed in these beautiful Givenchy dresses, which makes her look even more like a doll.
Yeah, the dresses were very, that's what I liked about, like, the costume designing. The dresses look really creepy because they look like at least 2-3 sizes too big for her. I mean, it looks like you could fit like two of her in the giant dress, and just the way she walks, and she's got the collar turned up, and you know, she's going like this. It's very, just with that mask and with that costume, it's very creepy.
Yeah, it's very Flowers in the Attic. It's very, what's the other thing it makes me think of? Oh, Chucky. You know, all the dolls that come alive, even the ventriloquist dolls that come alive, who have that frozen face, but something very, very sinister underneath.
Mm-hmm. And I was actually just watching to prepare for this, I watched a video with their interviewing Edith Skobb, who plays the character of Christiane. And she was, she ate very little. So she would lose a lot of weight just to get her in that role. And when she had to wear that mask entirely during filming, she couldn't take it off at all. Because I think they showed that there was some special like plastic or something that would have it stick to her face. So it wasn't something you could just easily rip off. And when they had her eat, it was during filming and they would break for lunch or whatever, they had her eat like some liquid food and she eat it through a straw. So you can sort of tell that, you know, she was really in that role.
So she really knew what it was like to wear that mask. Mm-hmm. So what do you think of the whole theme of a mask that's in this movie?
I think that's what makes this film so powerful is just that featureless mask. And it's creepy. And I like the fact that, except for maybe one scene, she doesn't talk at all. Right. When she's got the mask. She's almost like, I know it's French, but it seems very mime-like, you know?
It is very mime-like.
I think, and it's very silent, it's very a lot of ode to silent movies, and I think that's what's so great. I mean, and you see that featureless mask everywhere. I know Carpenter said in an interview when he was thinking of the mask for Michael Myers in the first Halloween movie, he was thinking of something like Eyes Without a Face. So you see that featureless mask through this creepiness of, you know, what's underneath. You see that in so many movies now. I think it's because of this movie.
Also, Phantom of the Opera. Mm-hmm. There's something very similar to that of, you know, there's still a real person under there, but something so damaged that you can't look at it full on. Mm-hmm. Also, a little bit of V for Vendetta, like do when you're behind the mask.
Mm-hmm. And I think when they reveal, that reveal, and I think of this film is what's so great. It builds it up. She takes off the mask. The woman wakes up on the surgical table. She gets the classic like horror movie scream, and then you finally see the face, and it's grotesque, and it's all very mangled. It's a great reveal.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's creepier, that scene or the one where they show after the skin graft, they show it being rejected. So
that's more necrotic.
That is super creepy.
Mm-hmm. Or the scene, which I'm surprised they got away with in 1960, is when they surgically remove her face. Yes. You only see it for a couple of seconds. They cut away, so you can't get a full grasp, but they see the face removed and just all all the blood and everything. Yeah. I'm pretty sure a lot of that is like what Hitchcock did with Psycho, a lot of chocolate syrup on her face, but very, very effective.
Very effective and very creepy. And mm-hmm. and also the scenes with the dogs, you know, I was waiting for them to go completely feral, like with the girl walking through there. I thought one of them was going to snap, mm-hmm. and it would be even more horrible than we had started out thinking. But the dogs are kind of a metaphor for what's going on in the main. I mean, they're all each in individual cages, mm-hmm. and he's removed parts of them to, you know, do his sort of Joseph Mengele stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still able to tell the difference between good and evil, because when she walks through, they don't mistake her for someone who is hurting.
Yeah, and that's another really great scene in the movie without any dialogue. She doesn't go, calm down, you know, I'm here. It's not anything like that. She comes in, the dogs are barking, they're going wild. She goes to each and every one of them, just kind of pets them a little bit, hugs them, and they all calm down and quiet. And then, you know, at that great reveal at the end, which is another very violent scene, you know, when she finally says, I've had enough, I can't do this anymore, she lets the dogs go free, and they'll run right past her, and they open the door, Mad Scientist in, and they just tear him up.
Eat him.
Yeah. And then you see that last shot at the end when she walks past him, and his face is all mangled because of the dogs.
Now, do you think this is meant to be a morality tale of some kind? If so, what's the message?
I don't know if it's a morality. It's like you say. It's just your basic. It's a sort of a unique twist on a classic tale of the mad scientist. You know, it's your Frankenstein. Maybe that man shouldn't meddle with. You know, shouldn't play God. Shouldn't meddle with stuff like this. And you know, take people's other parts off and try to fix other people who are broken. You shouldn't do something like that. It's more of like a classic new take on an old twist or something.
Yeah,
new twist on an old take.
Takes plastic surgery definitely to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, compared to what they have on TV today with, Nip Tuck and shows that, you know, detail what happens with medical examiners and CSI, everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that this is as frightening as it would have been when it came out in 1960?
So, like, if it was released, like, now?
Yeah.
Like I said, I think 1960s standards, it's very violent. Today, not so much. I mean, we've, in a way, I think we've become desensitized to violence. So, like, when you have, like, examples, Saw, which I think is the most violent horror film, one of the most violent horror films of all time, you're having people getting their intestines ripped out, leg, you know, decapitations, just blood, gore, nonstop. You see, this movie, it's like, oh, that's nothing. You know, that's nothing. I don't think people would be that shocked by it today if it came out.
What other movies do you think have been influenced by this?
Well, I said earlier, Halloween. Another film you talked about earlier on when you asked me about it, it's like, sounds a bit like Face Off.
Yeah.
And I think definitely John Woo did say that when he was kind of coming up with that idea of having, you know, that crazy idea in that movie. He was had this film in mind. He had Eyes Without a Face. And there's one film I haven't seen. I think it's a Spanish film. Antonio Banderas is in it. It's called The Skin I Live In.
Yes.
I think that was also a big influence in that movie. Have you seen that one?
No, but I have heard of it. The thing that they don't really address in the movie, because it's not really meant to be realistic, is there's more to what you look like than just putting the skin on. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that Edith Scobb's character looked exactly like herself is because the bones underneath are what make your face the shape and whatever that it is. But she looked so perfect after that one operation.
Mm-hmm. It's when she's at the dinner table and everybody thinks it's a success. Yeah.
If he is a mad scientist, you know, until it goes wrong, man, he's good.
Yeah, it goes good. He did a good job grafting that face. And you even talked about how similar she looks. Like, remember that scene when she's walking through and she sees the painting of, I think it's of herself, and she's got the bird on her hand.
Okay, so the birds. What theme or metaphor did you take from the doves?
I don't know. Maybe I think it's just the fact that you can tell, like, with the dogs, that she has this influence with animals. I think she trusts them and they trust her. And maybe because there's some kinship, like the birds are in a cage, the dogs are in a cage, she's basically in a cage. Maybe they sort of realize they're both are all caged. Like the dogs are being tested on, she's being experimented on, basically. So I think they have this kinship. And I think love that ending of the movie. It's extremely violent, but I think at the end they've all said, enough's enough. We need to end this. Let's go get them.
All right, so my final question is about the filmmaker himself saying that he did not think this was really a horror movie. He thought it was a movie about anguish. What do you
think? Yeah, I actually used that quote too. I agree. Let's see what actually he said. I got. He said, it's a quieter mood than horror. It's more internal, more penetrating. It's horror in homeopathic doses. I think there is a lot of melancholy in the movie. I think somebody actually listened to a podcast earlier. They said that, you know, horror movies can't be beautiful, can't be nice to look at. You know, they have to be all gruesome and, you know, and scary and all the time. If it's not, it wouldn't work very well.
The dark house with the cobwebs. And
exactly. And, you know, I think this movie sort of challenges that. And it's not quite a horror. You could say it's not quite a horror movie because it's got that melancholiness. It's got, you know, even the music, not the carnival one, but the do, 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 you know, as she's walking through, and there's a lot of poetic imagery. Like, I love that very last scene in the movie. It's when after, you know, she's escaped, and she's got the bird in her hand, you know, bird resting on her hand, and the dogs are running with her, and she's in the forest, and she's just going through. It's very hypnotizing, I would say. It's really good. You don't quite see that in a lot of horror movies. So, I guess going back to your question, it wouldn't quite, maybe not, like in some places, not quite a horror movie. It's a different kind of horror movie that you don't see a lot.
A Grimm's fairy tale you tell around the campfire.
Mm-hmm. It's showing the pearl necklace scar.
That's right. Instead of the black hand or the velvet choker.
So the screen, one thing I noticed was that looking at it, this was the screenplay by Pierre Belleau and Thomas Narcijac, I probably mispronounced that, but okay. And they were a huge screenwriting duo at the time. They also wrote worked on Diabolique, and they also wrote the book The Living and the Dead, which of course would be later adapted into Vertigo.
Oh, so they've actually had their fingers in lots of interesting suspense stories. Well, you know, this movie is terrific in terms of suspense. Just the way it's shot, the way you're waiting for something to happen. You kind of know what's going to happen. And then when it does happen, it's not as bad as you thought it was going to be, and you're relieved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your work, like that scene when...
What's in your head is so much worse.
Yeah, when the cops try to do that plant, which was an idiotic idea anyway, but... when it doesn't work and she's leaving the hospital and she's walking, you're like, uh-oh. And then the music's playing. Here yes. comes the car. She's like, oh, come in my car. I'll take you to the station. And you're thinking, oh, no. And then when she's on the surgical table, like, not again. But at the end, you know, Edith Skop is finally going to do the right thing and finally going to, you know, end this madness.
I think that's because she finally figures out what's going on. I don't know that she's a party to the crime. She's kind of dragged into it. She doesn't get to say yes or no.
And the beginning scene, which I think there's a good parallel, when we first see her and she's in her room, her face is buried in her pillow, and she's had enough. And the second scene is when the surgery fails again, and this time she's not on the bed buried in it, she's just on the floor, and it's just even worse for her.
Yeah, I guess that would be a good way of saying that's how he's depicting the anguish.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't, you know, given the choice, would she pick the mask? Would she go without the mask? What do you think she would choose?
The mask, I feel, has just become a part of her. I think, you know, by the beginning, she says, you know, you got to get used to what he says, you got to get used to wearing it. I think now she's become used to it in its own way. She's sort of embracing it. This is who she is now. This has made her, she's reborn in a way.
That's an interesting outlook.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I feel. Just like she's almost become, like they talk about how she's become angelic at that dinner table, like she's not something not human yet. I feel that's sort of what she is now. The way she has that, she doesn't talk. She talks very little. She has the influence with animals, you know, but the extreme influence. Like they, you know, they rest on her shoulder and everything. So that's, you know, she's something different than human, I would say.
Yeah, there is something angelic about her. And also, those giant dresses do make her look like the angel you'd stick on the top of the tree. Just that bell shape.
Exactly.
The director, Georges Franju, was actually very important in French film history because he founded the Cinémathèque Française, which is involved in archiving.
Mm-hmm. And I was doing some research. He has done a lot of other – he actually started out as a documentary filmmaker. And one documentary I noticed he did was called Blood of the Beasts. And it's like a 20-minute movie. It's talking about the conditions of slaughterhouses in France. And it was a pretty provocative movie because he would show like pictures of a serene little French suburbia and intercut that with graphic images of slaughterhouses, of, you know, animal carcasses and everything. And they got a lot of people riled up. So even then he was kind of doing this contrasting with, you know, quietness and then grotesqueness.
Well, now that I've seen what he can do with this movie, I don't know that I want to see that one with that topic.
So I was, so have you seen anything from his besides this?
No, I'm only familiar with him for his contributions to film history. I had not seen this movie before you told me to watch it. Very impressed with it. I did read, though, that he liked using Edith Skop in his other movies, so I haven't seen her in anything else.
Yeah. I checked out one film of his was at the library, and I checked it out. I know it's called Judex, and I think she's in that. And I think she's in a film called Therese, and another film. She had a cameo in a film he did right before this. It was called Head Against the Wall, where Pierre Bresser plays a doctor.
Of course. Hey, once a mad doctor, always a mad doctor.
Okay. And it was looking interestingly. Critics did not like this movie. And it was interesting. This was at the time of the French New Wave. And you're thinking this is sort of a time when people were open to new ideas and new things in cinema. And here they are being, to a new kind of horror movie, but they were completely shutting it down.
I think that's because it was so expressionistic. It looks very much like something the Germans would have done back
in
the 30s.
Yeah, very good point.
And it has the theme of the, you know, the insanity and the crazy doctor and the creepy surgical situations, the Frankenstein aspect. It's very mm-hmm. much in that vein. And, mm-hmm. you know, that would have been criticized.
Yeah, but the good news is, in 1986, it was re-released in places in London and France. And then everybody was like, oh, this is actually a very good movie. And it's now regarded as a classic. And I know one of the things when I first introduced you to this movie, you're like, oh, is that the title of the Billy Idol song?
Yep, do we have him to thank for the resurgence and the
Maybe. Thank you, Billy Idol. And he actually did say that this movie was the influence behind that song.
Oh, no. Yeah. I just wonder if he would have carried that through to some of his other songs.
And I'll have to ask you, you talked a bit about Pierre Bresser. Have you seen Edith Skop in anything?
I haven't. I was when I was looking up information about the director, I found out that he used her in other things, but I haven't seen anything other than this.
I know she was in a recent French film called Holy Motors. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Now, I do know that in that movie, though, I was reading it, that she's in the movie and she's wearing a mask, a white featureless mask.
Oh, I wonder if that's supposed to be an homage.
I think that's what it's supposed to be.
Might be worth seeing the movie just for that one cameo.
Let's see. And I was reading, one thing I did want to bring up also is the cinematography in this film was by Eugène Schuftan, who's a German cinematographer.
Oh, yes, the Schuftan process.
Yep. And he also did Metropolis and The Hustler. So, you know, it's another, that cinematography in the film, once again, is great. The use of black and white, the use of light and dark. I think you can definitely see that with him, with German expressionism, German cinematographer. I think you can definitely see that in his work with this movie.
Yeah, although I do think that they tried to make it not just, you know, the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think it was groundbreaking in what they did. It's hard to see it, though, because we're so used to all of those elements now, the mad scientist, mm-hmm. beautiful victim, and the crazy sidekick who's sort of Igor, but updated because now mm-hmm. it's a woman. Lots of these things they would have been fresh in 1960. Now they're just part of the canon. Mm-hmm.
So did it feel, when you watched it, do you feel, oh, this is kind of cliched?
I thought some of the things, it was like you'd seen them before, but mm-hmm. really you hadn't seen them yet if you watched everything in a linear way.
Okay, so anything else we're going to... Oh, I did want to bring up one more thing I thought that was funny. Talking about reception, it premiered at a film festival in Scotland. And when they watched it during that surgical scene when her face gets taken off, people fainted in the audience. And after director George Franju said, "Now I know why Scotsmen wear skirts."
Yes. Well, you know, that scene where they actually remove the face, that was really... That still is creepy, even
by
today's standards. Just because they really go there.
Mm-hmm. And then you see when he's moving the scalpel, they show it. The scalpel,
yes.
And there's blood dripping, even though it's probably chocolate syrup, but the blood's dripping, and you're like, oof.
Yeah, I had to watch most of that scene from underneath my coat.
Okay, so now we're getting close to the end of my questions. Is there anything else you want to ask me or have me ask you? Are you into your questions? Or
any other themes that you saw in the film that we didn't talk about? We have anguish. We have harking back to the expressionistic tropes.
I think we've covered everything. I guess we could maybe a little bit about the lost connection between the fiancé, Jacques, and Christiane.
Yes, wasn't that sad the way she kept calling him and not saying anything? And, you know, again, this is the kind of thing in today's day and age. You'd be like, well, you're going to star 6ix9ine. Mm-hmm. Besides, you know, we'd totally be able to tell who's calling you. But, yeah, things like that are about how telephones used to work, but that's not how we use them now. That kind of thing does seem kind of quaint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is a sad scene, though, when he sort of suspects, and he has the cops even pull that little trick for him, but it doesn't work. And then they, they say, "Oh, well, you'll be fine. Your heart will move. You'll move on."
It's right.
Kind of sad.
Yeah, that is kind of sad. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Georges Franju and his 1960 classic Eyes Without a Face.
And just to give you all a reminder, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or at our new podcast page, dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. We are under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you. Did a fantastic job of being the interviewer this time. How do you think I did as the interviewee?
I think you did great as the interviewee. It was fun to turn the tables.
Awesome. And I'll have you sign us off.
All right. Until next time, I'm your host of the Armchair Directors, Marie Westhaver, saying smile, not too much.